Although built in 1898, the Goldsmith House falls outside the Alphabet Historic District and is therefore not subject to historic review. The NWDA Planning Committee meets weekly, but we needed to hold several additional emergency meetings to address this urgent issue. In the meantime, BDS announced its reinterpretation of the so-called K1 exception that would have subjected this project to the demo delay rules, including the 120-day exception. It was a key component of the negotiations and tentative agreement reached by NWDA with the developer to suspend demolition while an alternative was sought. When it was determined that the city's reinterpretation would not retroactively apply, however, the developer rescinded his agreement and resumed demolition. It ultimately took the swift and Herculean efforts of individual neighbors Rick Michelson and Karen Carlson to save this house in the absence of an agreement between NWDA and the developer. We are very lucky, but we cannot be so lucky every time. The draft proposes a voluntary 30-day extension to prevent abuse and unproductive negotiations that would prolong the process. The current code, however, and this is something you haven't heard, I don't think, already provides protection to the applicant, who can appeal the 120-day extension at any time if the neighborhood association has not made a good faith effort to work with the applicant. This protection preserves the applicant's rights to develop its property and the neighborhood's right to try to save viable housing, fulfilling the purpose of the demo delay rules. Please do not eliminate the 120-day extension. And if I could answer any questions about the 5% of historic homes not subject to the
May want to follow up with you about that rather than do it now, just for time's sake. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Barbara.
Good afternoon. My name is Barbara Kerr, and I am here to ask you to establish deconstruction as the standard method of demolition. I was a founder of Rejuvenation, originally Rejuvenation House Parts Company, and an early board member of the Rebuilding Center. The guys I worked alongside salvaging house parts for repair, restoration, or rehab in the 70s and 80s were called hand wreckers. Now they're called deconstructionists. Deconstruction is dismantling a building in order to reuse the materials which would otherwise be crushed into mulch or fuel or go to the landfill. It is demolition and should be considered if and only if a house has to be removed and relocation is not feasible. As the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability's website says, the greenest house is the one that is already built. But if a house must be demolished, deconstruction is the only sustainable method. The list of benefits of deconstruction versus mechanical demolition is long, reducing the need for landfills, the transportation to them, and the methane released by them, reducing the need for harvesting virgin timber and other materials, and the environmental costs of their extraction, processing, and transport, minimizing the neighbor's exposure to toxic dust, excessive noise, or unnecessary physical danger, providing affordable and very often higher quality building materials, providing parts that would not otherwise be available for people to move affordably to more affordably repair and maintain their older homes, creating entry-level employment that can be pre-training for apprenticeships that lead to higher-skilled long-term jobs, creating small business opportunities for people who otherwise may not have opportunities, and preserving some of the beauty and craftsmanship of earlier times. Even with so many incentives, only a small number of demolitions in Portland are deconstructions. Work with the Rebuilding Center and the rest of the local and national international reuse community to create a clear and thorough definition of deconstruction, from how much of the building is reused and what qualifies as reuse, to what safety standards are required both in materials removal and on-site sales. Revise regulations to make it easier for contractors to deconstruct and to reuse building materials. Deconstruction is labor-intensive, but that is an upside for economic development. For job training and employment programs, dismantling a house in the reverse order of how it was built teaches knowledge and work habits for the construction trade, a good precursor for apprenticeships. In turn, training programs can make deconstruction more affordable. Deconstruction goes a long way to meeting the city's environmental, economic, and social goals, and it can make sense for everyone.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
My name is Terry Parker. I'm a fourth-generation Portlander, and I'm speaking on behalf of the UNR Steering Committee, which I am a member. When my neighborhood, Rose City Park, was platted over 100 years ago, the developers clearly envisioned a residential village in a park geared to the working class. Today, the working class is often called the 99%. Even before zoning was implemented, early deeds required homes to be set back 15 feet from the street. It has been said the greenest building is the one that is already built. Get the one here. Sorry about this. Trying to get a... Carla, can you get that up for me?
There we go.
Thank you. Sorry about the delay there.
Okay.
Teardowns, the reality is that for a variety of reasons, some single-family home replacement is going to take place. Teardowns, however, must be done with more respect, responsibility, and sustainability. Metro and the city want people to sort their garbage so less trash goes to the landfill. Yet, Portland is in the rears when it comes to managing home demolitions. Private property becomes a public problem when 75% or more of a single-family home is sent to the landfill, and when dust and potentially hazardous materials are spread and trespass on neighboring properties. Done right and without the diesel fumes from excavators infiltrating kitchens, living rooms, and our parks, 60% or more of the materials from a deconstructed home can be reused. When a single-family home is permitted to be torn down, deconstruction needs to replace mechanical demolition as the norm. It is clearly the right thing to do, and there are tax write-offs for developers who donate the reuse of materials to places like the Rebuilding Center. The city can kickstart this standard by accepting the UNR request to adopt a workable definition of demolition, as recommended by community experts, and by adding incentives to the demolition process that favor deconstruction. Additionally, the city also needs to seek disincentives for mechanical demolition, such as encouraging Metro to immediately increase the tipping fees for home demolition debris, tenfold if necessary, to motivate a reduction. The wrecking ball approach in the race to replace is clawing at the fabric of our neighborhoods. New houses that replace older homes often extend to the edges of the lot lines, the unsurpassed park for any parent that wants to keep tabs on a small child as their own backyard. Without the ribbons of green that backyards and front yards provide, the buyers of replacement homes are getting less for their money. The living environment is compromised and housing becomes less affordable. We need to keep neighborhoods like mine affordable while still maintaining the longstanding values and intended visions of the residential village in a park setting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next three are Jim Hewer, Jim Brown, and Gary Clifford. They'll be followed by Sarah Long, Steve Elder, and Jack Bookwalter.
Go ahead.
Good evening. I understand we are running very late, so I'll be brief. But there are
name for the record.
I'm sorry, Jim Hoyer is my name, and I'm a volunteer with the United Neighborhoods for Reform. We're at an important juncture in our presentations tonight. We've had a lot of conversation about the DRAC recommendations. Our basic position on this is that we like most of it, but there's one key piece, as you well have heard, that we do not like. And our recommendation to you is to send this proposed ordinance language back to the drafting unit at BDS with the suggestion that they remove the language relating to the 120-day delay. One of the things that we are asking for is the task force, and we've discussed that before, is the what happens afterwards. But that task force is really a policy-oriented task force, and it might conceivably also be enabled to look at other ways to make the decision about whether there's a public policy value in stopping a particular demolition. I suspect over time we'll have a chance to share more information with you about the impact of these demolitions that don't really, that they have the effect of reducing the growth of our single-family housing inventory. The BPS plan for this, the comprehensive plan, projects 28,000 new single-family houses in 20 years. If we continue to demolish at the same rate versus the build rate, we'll only get about 8,000 houses built. So this has a big impact. The task force we've talked about, it has to be focused on the comp plan. There's some very specific parts of it, policy 4.13 on infill construction, 5.33 on preserving small resource efficient homes. We need to turn that into reality. There's no mechanism. We've been through the comp plan from one end to the other. We've looked at the wonderful map app. We can find no place to address these issues. We need a task force similar to the one on mixed-use zoning that is able to pick apart the details of the zoning code. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Welcome. You're next.
Good afternoon. I'm James Paul Brown. I live in the Alameda neighborhood and have for some time. I chair the Land Use and Transportation Committee for the Neighborhood Association. Over the last 3 years, homeowners have contacted us about the increasing trend of demolitions of good, smaller homes. Their removal reduces affordability and diversity, but investors purchase such homes to replace to maximize their profits. Of the more than 20 new homes recently constructed in Alameda, only 4 were infill, built on vacant lots, and this didn't go. Well, Pardon the delay. I guess we won't see them.
There it is.
It's all right. The new homes typically cost about $900,000 and are 2 to 3 times larger than the $400,000 homes they replace. The style of most of these barn-sized new homes is 1910 faux craftsmen. Among our modest-sized 1920s homes, they appear out of place and incompatible. Three other new homes in Alameda are a more radical style, each close to the sidewalk, towers over the neighboring homes, and looks even more out of place than the faux craftsman structures. One policy expert group that met to help update the city's comprehensive plan focused on residential design and compatibility. Along with slides of other incompatible examples, one of Alameda's other style homes was shown. After thorough discussion, consensus was that out-of-context homes detract from neighborhoods. Language in Chapter 4 of the proposed comprehensive plan addresses neighborhood context compatibility. There are some grand homes in Alameda, but most homes on the avenues are story-and-a-half English cottage styles or bungalows on 5,000-square-foot lots. Space around these homes allows daylight to shine into windows and enough backyard for gardens, patios, etc. Oversized, hulking new homes cover their own lots and blot out the sun next door. Most homeowners choose their homes after careful consideration. When they make that big decision, they not only buy the home, they buy the neighborhood. Over time, they invest heart and soul as well as dollars. Their commitment deserves more respect than is shown by speculators who smash, build, and move on. I encourage the council to authorize creation of that broadly based task force recommended by UNR. Appropriate regulations can protect the individual homeowners and our neighborhoods to keep Portland, Portland. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Gary Clifford. I'm with UNR. I was a land use planner with Multnomah County for 28 years. Half of that time a senior planner responsible for zoning code revisions. I'm addressing today the problem that occurs primarily in the R5 zone, where a single-family house on 5,000 square feet of property is replaced with two houses on two 2,500 square foot lots. This happens because the original house was built on and usually across two platted lots. From the 1970s, it was consistently explained to me by knowledgeable individuals and older citizens that had worked in real estate in the early 20th century that these subdivision plats with narrow 25-foot wide frontage were never expected to be individual building sites. The lotting format was a marketing tool that allowed a buyer to not only buy the expected 50-foot wide two platted lots together, but also the buyer would have the option to add a third platted lot for more yard or a garden space, three lots side by side, or even four platted lots together for building a larger house. When Multnomah County had urban planning jurisdiction, the zoning ordinance always stated clarely that the 25 by 100 foot lots were not individual building lots. The zoning ordinance read, quote, "In no case shall a dwelling unit have a lot area less than 3,000 square feet." This was by design, so the two platted lots always stayed together as a group. By allowing the current lot splitting practice, the city of Portland is blatantly disregarding its responsibility to protect the stability expected by homeowners in the zoning code. The Portland zoning code does have rules about not building two houses immediately when one is demolished, but they can circumvent that rule by declaring the house to be dangerous. And that can be easily made by leaving the utilities off and the no heat for a winter, mm-hmm. and they let it deteriorate.
Let me stop you there. We do have the rest of your written testimony.
Okay.
So it's very helpful. And all three of you provided good copies, so that's all very right. helpful to us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's take three more.
Are Sarah Long, Steve Elder, and Jack Bookwalter. And they'll be followed by Preston Browning, Ben Gates, and Joe Canwell. Or Connell.
Go ahead. Welcome.
I'm just going to start because we're short on time. Right. My name is Sarah Long. I live in Elliott, one of our closest and most historic neighborhoods. I am on Elliott's Land Use and Transportation Committee, and I am the vice chair of the Elliott Neighborhood Association. In this capacity, I'm working on massively increasing close-in density and affordability by promoting mixed-use development of our many vacant lots, particularly those right on transit corridors, and redevelopment of our vast amounts of empty and unused surface parking into permanently affordable housing. Elliott is in the footprint of the historic city of Albina, platted in 1873. It is the historically black neighborhood, and today, black residents of Elliott, whose families have been here for generations, have been priced out, and those who remain have few services as black businesses have been pushed out by gentrification and shuttered. In the former city of Albina, we have lost over 10,000 African-American residents, and landmarks of black history in Portland aren't protected. That's who I am, but today I'm here on behalf of United Neighborhoods for Reform to talk to you about tree protections. From the seven key directions to achieve in the vision of the 2035 Comprehensive Plan, number six is our goal to improve resiliency. We will, and I quote, prepare for climate change and reduce risks posed by natural hazards. Trees help reduce harmful flooding, cool the city on hot summer days, and reduce health, safety, and economic risks for households, businesses, and the city. Key direction four on page I-23 of the Comprehensive Plan states, but many of Portland's valuable natural resources are at risk. Trees that reduce heat island effects and provide habitat are vulnerable to development. Without thoughtful intervention, human and ecological health will suffer. This plan includes policies to improve human and environmental health. We know that Portland has one of the worst urban heat islands in the United States. We know that our hills and vales combined with rainfall mean erosion on the small hills and landslides on our big hills are a huge issue for all. We know that a single mature tree can filter 60 pounds of pollutants from the air each year, and yet we are not protecting our trees. New regulations going to affect January 2nd. However, a developer can simply pay $1,200 and chop it down. Let's contrast this to the city of Lake Oswego, where if a tree is over 10 inches in diameter, 5 feet above the ground, then the following applies. The permit requires more intensive evaluation and staff time and takes approximately 1 month to complete. The applicant posts a sign obtained from the city that describes the proposed tree removal. This begins the 14-day public comment period during which staff reviews the application and makes a site visit. At the end of the comment period, staff issues a tentative decision. If the tentative decision is for approval, a second sign will be posted by staff, which starts a 14-day appeal period. During this period, the tentative decision can be appealed to the Development Review Commission. Portland's trees are so valuable that they deserve better, and so do we. I have confidence in you, our elected officials, to keep Portland deserving of its reputation as a green and well-managed city.
Thank you very much. Welcome. We'd like to go next.
You're next.
Good afternoon. I'm Steve Elder. I live in the Concordia neighborhood, and I heartily endorse the remarks of my neighbors about the 120 days and the deconstruction versus demolition. But I am going to depart a little bit from the standard, as some of the other people have, and talk about the issue of solar development. Consideration should be given to solar access and development for both new and existing structures. Portland should consider and deal with the impact of sun and shadow on residences in its jurisdiction. Action in support of sunshine should address issues of residences that may be overshadowed by new construction. We have all seen new construction extending 35 feet into the sky and putting an existing house in the shade. On the north side in the shade. The impact may be that the shaded house can't avail itself of incentives for solar development. There might not be enough sunshine for solar panels. Even if the neighbor wasn't contemplating installation of photovoltaic devices, he might find his tomatoes won't ripen. Although affording protection to neighbors affected by overshadow of new construction is prospective, not retrospective. It's not just a matter of the way the neighborhood has always been, but how the neighborhood will be going forward. Solar energy has been endorsed generally and specifically by the Comprehensive Plan, 4.7 and 4.8, but the city itself has started well. Solar Forward is a very good program, but it's not there anymore. There is much that has been done, but there's much that has not been done. When you fly over Portland, you don't see solar panels. When you fly over Frankfurt, Germany, you see a lot of solar panels. And that is something that can be done. Frankfurt, Germany is farther north than Portland. You could say, well, it changes in latitude. Frankfurt is much farther north, but they have a whole lot more. Germany has many times more solar panels than we do. I recognize that, the city should address the issue of overshadowing. I urge council to address issues of solar energy, which is good, and solar shading, which can have a deleterious effect on the neighbors. The issues raised are progressive, not regressive. They are clearly definable and not matters of opinion or aesthetic sensitivity. You can measure how much house the sun will get. How much sun a house will get. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Welcome.
Jack Bookwalter, Beaumont Mosher Neighborhood Association Land Use Chair, and also a member of UNR. I want to talk today about the expanding the historic resources inventory of the city. Portland's existing historic resources inventory dates from 1984. While helpful in the past in identifying historic resources built prior to World War II and in specific neighborhoods, the inventory is woefully inadequate in presenting an accurate view of what is and what is not historic in the city today. No post-war buildings were included in the survey. 30 years ago, they were not considered historic. Since then, we have come to appreciate a whole new genre of historic buildings we now know as mid-century modern. The inventory thusly missed notable buildings such as the Colosseum and the buildings and houses of architect Pietro Belluschi, buildings that are prominent not only just locally, but on the world architectural stage. An updated inventory would aid in planning decisions of many types, as well as in analyzing demolition decisions. Planners and the city would be able to make better informed decisions, and neighborhood associations could better be able right away to assess the historic and architectural importance of a building threatened by demolition. And developers might find it useful in deciding whether to purchase a home or not if they knew ahead of time that the city had deemed it to be of historic significance, if for no other reason than the desire to avoid properties that may result in some sticky conflicts with neighborhood groups. The draft of the new comp plan contains language stressing importance of historic inventories. Policy 4.24, protect, restore, and improve historic buildings and centers and corridors on adopted inventories. 4.41, expand historic inventories to encourage historic preservation in areas that are underrepresented by current historic preservation efforts. 4.40, survey and inventory historic resources as part of future planning projects with a focus on areas of anticipated growth and change. Furthermore, Landmarks Commission, CN, at its annual presentation to Council on July 31st of this year, requested $20,000 for a pilot neighborhood historic resource inventory study. This study would be followed by expansions of the inventory in the subsequent years after that. UNR strongly recommends adoption of the Landmarks Commission's request to expand the historic resources inventory. Not doing so would be penny-wise and pound-foolish on the city's part. The city could save itself, its citizens, and its business people much time, expense, and grief by getting started on the inventory right away. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Mr. Bookwalter, I just want to say I was up in the air about your request, but then when you got to the punchline, the city could save itself a lot of grief by making a modest $20,000 investment. You got my support.
Thank you. Okay, so let's take three more people because we are going to lose a quorum at 6, and then I think we'll have to continue January after that. So,
okay. The next three are Preston Browning, Ben Gates, and Joe Connell.
And how many are there after that, Carla?
I believe we've got about 14 more after that.
So sorry, folks, we're not going to be able to get everybody in today, but we'll take those three and then we'll figure out how we're going to continue.
Okay.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, commissioners and mayor. My name is Ben Gates, real estate developer and board member of the Rebuilding Center. I've had the pleasure of facilitating a diverse deconstruction work group that has striven to work with and in parallel effort to the DRAC Demolition Policy Subcommittee. As Nancy Thorington alluded to, DRAC did not have time to properly consider deconstruction, and this is where we stepped in. Our work group is comprised of developers, builders, deconstruction contractors, neighborhood representatives, and those who salvage and repurpose deconstructed material. We would like to propose that the demolition policy being considered today be amended to include a voluntary incentive for deconstruction This straightforward proposal has been submitted for the record, and you should have it in your hands. And if adopted, this amendment would provide a voluntary incentive for the deconstruction of a home in lieu of demolition. I'll let others who follow speak to the merits of deconstruction and why this makes good policy sense, so I can give you a brief introduction to the proposal in your hands. The proposal contains three parts: a definition, an incentive, and a program for deconstruction. The deconstruction definition is simple. Basically, 75% of the weight of waste materials generated from dismantling a structure must be salvaged for reuse. Salvage material could be sold, donated, or reused on site as part of new construction. And the deconstruction program would be easy to administer by the city with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. A detailed program guide would be developed, a list of deconstruction contractors maintained, job posted, and inspections conducted randomly. The deconstruction incentive part would reduce the demolition delay from 35 days to 10 days. In order to qualify for the reduced deconstruction delay, the building owner or agent must secure written approval from the neighborhood association and agree to use a qualified deconstruction contractor. So this addresses Jeff Fish's concern of protecting the neighborhood. Basically, it requires their sign-off to get this reduced delay.
Quick question. Does the 70% figure, is that based on the fact that you assume that some of these buildings from the 20s, for example, are likely to have lead paint or asbestos in the basement, so you're assuming that's not salvageable and you're looking at the rest?
Correct. There's some things that are difficult to salvage and can't be salvaged, like hazardous materials. And then some things like concrete, which is difficult to repurpose but easy to recycle. We urge you to amend the demolition policy to include a voluntary option for deconstruction. Thank you for the opportunity to present this proposed amendment.
So just to, the challenge with that is that neighborhood associations only meet once a month. So unless you happen to have a neighborhood association meeting, that it would run the 35 days. You couldn't get a neighborhood association meeting to sign off on it to then give the incentive.
And that is addressed through seeking neighborhood approval for the deconstruction
activity. Right, but you can't get the neighborhood approval because
the neighborhood group and United Neighborhoods for Reform are in support of this 10-day reduction with the sign-off of the association.
Well, it just doesn't work logistically because neighborhood associations only meet once a month. So by the time you had gotten the sign-off, you'd be at the end of your 35 days. So I think we do want to have some more discussion about potential incentives for deconstruction, but that's not – it would take a complete reworking of what the proposal on the table to incorporate something like that. And it actually would mean a longer demo delay in order to allow for the deconstruction incentive. So I understand it sounds like it's an easy thing to do, but it doesn't work with the proposal that's on the table.
Well, we think it's an easy thing to do, and so does United Neighborhoods for Reform and neighborhood associations we've been in contact with.
All right, thank you. Welcome.
I was going to say good afternoon, but good evening. My name is Preston Browning, and I'm the owner of Salvage Works in the Kenton neighborhood of North Portland. We sell reclaimed lumber from deconstructed homes and barns, and have a shop that fabricates custom furniture and commercial fixtures from that material. I'm speaking to council today about the economics of reclaimed lumber and deconstruction from a small and sustainable business perspective. 5 years ago, I started Salvage Works on my own and grossed $60,000. This year, I have 8 full-time employees and will gross $600,000. We're growing and expanding, moving to a new space. We'll have 2 new employees next year. If you've gone out to dinner or drinks in Portland lately, you've probably noticed that most new places are building their interiors with reclaimed wood. It's on the floors and the walls and the bar and the tabletops. It's kind of all the rage these days. And it's not just in Portland. People are looking to Portland for our food and coffee scene. And they're looking to us for design sense as well, and this is incorporated into that. So we've built out or supplied material to 100 establishments in Portland in the last few years. Contractors, fabrication shops are looking to us for this material to build not just local places, but stores, restaurants, and bars all over the country. One of our customers is a big fabrication shop in town. They got a contract to build 18 clothing shops nationwide. Each store requires about 5,000 board feet of reclaimed lumber, which is about a yield from a single deconstructed home. So what I'm really getting at is that we have lost opportunities and lost resources. A challenge I'm facing is a supply problem. Without more deconstruction, salvage works can't meet the demand for the reclaimed wood. With a deconstruction incentive in Portland's demolition policy, this would change. Traditional philosophy in the demolition industry is to crunch and dump as fast as possible, and that's changing. I have now relationships with demolition contractors who are deconstructing because it makes economic sense. You know, I'm buying this material from them. I think it's also important to note, that deconstruction means jobs, and not just for the deconstruction work, but it trickles down into, in the retail and manufacturing sector, fabrication, construction, and new projects. And these are skilled living wage jobs with lots of room for advancement. So I think that if a deconstruction was included in the demolition policy, skeptics would really come around pretty fast because it's the jobs, the exchange of goods, the tax income, and the design culture are all good things to me. So
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Joe Connell. I'm Vice President of Retail Operations for Habitat for Humanity of Portland. As you all know, Habitat for Humanity is a nonprofit affordable housing organization. We build homes in partnership with civic entities, businesses, and individuals. As I think you're also aware, part of our work is funded through the resale of donated materials through our ReStores. To date, our three metro area stores have raised $3 million for Habitat and saved roughly 40 million pounds of materials from the waste stream. This social enterprise represents an extremely valuable service to our community through the savings of natural resources, job creation, community building, and, of course, the creation of affordable home ownership. This year alone, the work of the ReStores will provide for the building of 12 Habitat homes in our metro area. Our capacity is tremendous. There is also, as we all know, an endless need for affordable housing and an endless supply of good products going to the landfill. One of the keys for increasing our business and thus providing more homes is more donations, more materials coming into our stores. In a time when more and more nonprofits are looking at social enterprises to provide the extra funding they need, Habitat's model is an example to all. We and the other organizations and businesses here are prime examples of how waste can be turned into a valuable resource for our community. The need we all share is for more of this waste to be diverted away from the traditional model of disposal. I think it's a tremendous opportunity to make a great impact with minimal investment. Deconstruction is one of the most direct ways in which we can invest in ourselves as a community with extremely minimal investment. Over the last decade, I've seen a great deal of growth in the reuse sector nationwide. Where there is more opportunity, however, is in getting civic entities to provide legislation and policy that creates more incentive to the community to get involved in this process of upcycling our waste to help improve ourselves. Habitat's famous mantra has always been that we offer a hand up, not a hand out. What we are all asking for here is for the city to provide more incentive and direction to help support our community in helping itself. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Well, this has been an excellent hearing. I'm sorry we haven't been able to get to everybody today, but I really appreciate all the great testimony. We have to figure out exactly when we'll carry this over to for further deliberation. One possibility is tomorrow because we have some items on the calendar with time certain that might not take the full time. Another is to set another date in January. You have a preference, Commissioner Fritz?
Do we have room to do it tomorrow?
I think we do because I don't think that the 2 p.m. item, which happens to be a demolition case, is going to take that long. We have two witnesses left in rebuttal from the applicant and a council deliberation and decision. So
maybe
I'm sure we'll
have a half hour for that?
Yeah, I think it's a half hour proceeding. So
that means if the current pattern holds, half hour means 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, there is a benefit for having a little more time unless we're time sensitive, which is there have been some issues raised that we could have a chance to talk to the sponsor about and staff. So just back to that.
Yeah, I'm actually interested in a little time as well, in that we're going to have to get people to come back anyway. So if you don't, those of you who want to come back, don't mind coming back in a couple of weeks instead of 24 hours.
In a month. We don't have meetings.
So this is going to be mid-January. But again, obviously there's some urgency to this issue, but not. But a couple more weeks or days won't necessarily make the difference. So I'm going to just... A couple more weeks. We're not meeting next week or the week after because of when the holidays fall. Oh, you're asking for more time. Okay, good.
Well, but let's be clear that this is for finishing up the testimony of the folks who've signed up.
Right. So, yes, I know there are two of them right there. So I don't know if you have the time certain calendar in front of you. If we could just pick a date in January now, that might be helpful if we can.
Would the morning work? I've only got 1 15-minute time certain, but I know that throws the regular agenda
off. I'm sorry, say that again, Carla.
The morning of the 7th, if you want to do the first week. The second week is January is booked for time certain.
So you're talking about January 7th in the morning. We have only 1 15-minute time certain item now.
Yeah, otherwise you'd be looking at, I don't know if that COCO contract
I'm essentially gone between now and then.
But you're gone.
Yeah. So you'd rather wait till later in the month?
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you have later in the month?
You're gone the third week of the month, Mayor, and so you're looking at the end of the month, unless you want to come back without the mayor the third week.
Just finishing up the testimony on first reading.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'd like the mayor to be involved in the discussion, so maybe the last week.
So last week of January?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to pick a one of those two dates.
Can we do it in the afternoon, Carla?
It would be Thursday at 3:30 again.
Thursday the
29th.
Thursday the 29th, 3:30. We have a 2 p.m. time certain that day.
That's the URA amendments.
Yeah, okay.
That's not going to work. Please don't anyone pile on when I just offer this suggestion, but we sometimes do work sessions on a Tuesday. Are we prohibited from doing a council session on Tuesday?
Yes, I believe we are. Is that right?
Well, that would be a special meeting, and you can do a special meeting as long as you announce it, and the code requirement is a written notice from at least three members signing off.
The thing about this is...
I'm open to that.
January is so jammed.
We've got a lot going on.
If we did a Tuesday, then we would at least have the time to focus on it without it bumping up against all these other things.
We have to show up for work anyway.
But it would actually be a public hearing and we'd get to vote on it.
So,
is that correct? That it would be a special meeting, it would be a public hearing, we'd get to vote on it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So one possibility would be Tuesday the 20th.
You're out of town.
Well, I'm not sure which day I'm leaving. So let's talk about Tuesday the 13th. How's that sound?
I don't do the notable scheduling, but I don't have anything right
you
now.
You wouldn't have anything in the council calendar.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to tentatively, we'll notice this because there are other folks like our schedulers involved who are either going to jump out a window or affirm that this is okay. But I'm going to tentatively set this for 10 a.m., let's say, or 9:30 a.m., because we often have work sessions at 9:30 on Tuesdays. 9:30 a.m. for Tuesday, January 13th. And again, bear with us. We might revise that if there's a problem with a quorum. But at least for planning purposes, that's what we're going to
say. For those of you who haven't testified, you get us fresh.
I might not be here then.
Okay. All right, that won't work.
I might be coming back from Dallas.
You might be coming back from Dallas. Then how about Tuesday?
I'll get you at the airport. I'll get you.
I just figured that out.
Yes, thank you.
I just figured
Tuesday
that out.
Tuesday the 27th.
That is a work session already scheduled for PERB.
All right.
I'll tell you January 2nd whether I'll be here. January 1st at about.
Let's stick with the 13th for now, and we'll see what happens.
No. You wouldn't. No, that would jinx it for sure.
Oh.
We do the afternoon?
I don't have my flights booked yet. I have my tickets saved.
Well, we are not going to interfere with that.
For those of you who are not football fans, the Oregon Ducks, if they win on January 1st, will be in Dallas for the national championship on January 12th. And
Commissioner Fritz is not a football fan, but she's representing the city at this event. Great self-sacrifice. She drew the shortest lot on that one.
If you caught me smiling earlier, my son texted me to say that the Ducks told us we got our tickets.
I believe, let's do this. I believe my travel schedule for the U.S. Conference of Mayors involves either flying out the evening of the 20th or the morning of the 21st. So I'm going to tentatively set this for 9:30 a.m. on the 20th on the assumption that I can still get out of town in time to show up for that. So 9:30 a.m. On Tuesday, January 20th, and again, bear with us if we have to revise that. That's the plan for now.
Okay. That's a regular meeting, not a work session.
Regular meeting. Regular City Council will take testimony from those who've signed up and haven't gotten a chance to speak today. Thank you all for your patience and for good testimony, and we're recessed till tomorrow.